Court's ready to hear argument in Sloan versus Siegel.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to introduce Frank Sloan to the court. He has been admitted pro hoc vice for purposes of the oral argument.
Hey, welcome to the court, Mr. Sloan.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I'm going to start your clock. You'll see a green light. You have a total of 20 minutes. When the yellow light comes on, that will be the time you're reserved. You can continue, but you'll be using the time you reserved.
I understand. Thank you very much. May it please the court. Petitioners brought this action seeking to have the principal of the Martin Sloan Trust adjudicated to belong to them. The trust provided that unless Patricia Sloan exercised the power of appointment in favor of other of her offspring, then the remainder of the Martin Sloan Trust would go to petitioners in equal amounts. Now, everybody knew that the core issue at the time of the trial was what happened at the time the codicil was executed July 1, 2003. That was the focus. This case goes beyond undue influence. This is a case of total control and domination. By July 1, 2003, Lewis Siegel had total control over Patricia and her entire estate. By that time, she'd been in a secure dementia unit for over 8 months, where she had no telephone and received no mail. Respondent received her mail. Respondent was here, her gatekeeper to the world. It was Respondent who determined what communications would be, what information she would get, and what information he would relay to others about her. And as you know from the judge's finding, he concealed information about her. Now, he made all the medical.
Ultimately, this is a question of fact, right? Undue influence?
No.
Or is it mixed?
Not entirely, because the trial court noted that Lewis had, respondent, had failed to explain the circumstances surrounding both his drafting of the codicil and the execution of it. Now, he had testified, we got him to admit on direct examination. He prepared it. He brought the secure dementia facility. He was present when she signed it. He took it home with her. And then, as the trial court found, we met our burden of proof under Melson. The burden shifted to him.
Well, was that argued that this adverse inference should apply?
It was argued twice. It was argued in our initial post-trial brief and our response post-trial brief two times. And as you know, it was ignored by the trial court. The legal implications were simply ignored. And it was in a very important factor. One of the things that the testimony of respondent was always, Mom wanted me to do this, Mom wanted me to do that. Conclusory assertions of fact. No explanations about conversations, no circumstances. In this case, it's not, under Florida law it's an adverse inference, but under Delaware law and under common law, it's more than that. The Smith v. Van Gorkum case says that when you introduce weak evidence, when you've got strong, the conclusion must be that the strong evidence was adverse to your interests. And it cites the United States Supreme Court case in Interstate Circuit versus United States. And that the cite for that is contained in the Van Gorkum. It goes beyond and cites another United States Court opinion which says, silence then becomes evidence of the most convincing character. So the trial judge failed to consider evidence of the most convincing character. This is both a legal error and it's a factual error. The other thing that the trial judge did.
Why do you say, if it was argued, why do you say he failed to consider it?
Pardon?
If it was argued twice, he heard it, right?
So it was argued in brief.
So why did he fail to consider it? Or how do you demonstrate that?
Because he didn't address the legal issue. Okay, I can't the last thing I'm going to do is come up here and tell you that I'm going to read somebody's mind, and I know exactly what his thought processes were. But reading the opinion, it's clear he didn't address the issue. Not only didn't he address the issue, respondent didn't address the issue. In their response brief, they didn't address the issue, and they haven't addressed it before this court.
Well, let's put that issue in the context of other things that are in the case. The vice chancellor did find that Lewis was not credible. The vice chancellor shifted the burden to Lewis, and then the vice chancellor appears to conclude that Patricia not only would have wanted to do this, but according to the vice chancellor, would have insisted on doing this. So how do we fit this all together?
Very, very good. Okay, the problem with that finding, okay, about it's speculation on the part of the chancellor, because he says if she had been told, this is what, there was no testimony about what she was told. We don't know what she was told about this document. We don't know whether she read it or could have understood it. We don't know what information she was given by Lewis Siegel.
But what the vice chancellor says in his opinion is the testamentary scheme seemed to be fairly consistent. And he concluded, the vice chancellor, that there was some discrepancy on whether she thought she had effectively exercised her power of appointment. And if she knew that she had somehow confused the two trusts and not effectively exercised her power of appointment, she would have wanted to do that to be consistent with her longstanding plan.
Okay, there are two things I want to address in answering your question. First of all, the actual testimony plan as evidenced by what had gone on previously, all right? Important date there is September 6, 2001. On that date, she executes two documents, Fourth Amendment to a trust and a codicil to her will. These are prepared by Jerome Grossman, attorney, Delaware attorney specializing in wills and trust. Okay? He testified at trial that he went over with her, and then after it was prepared, he went over and she signed it. What she did is she treated her will differently than she treated the exercise of the power of appointment. The will she put in the codicil she put in that she was that petitioners and their offspring were not to be considered as her offspring for purposes of her will. However, what she did in the trust was she went ahead and she eliminated the Lewis Siegel Trust, which was going to set up a trust where he would be the income beneficiary of the first $500,000 of the Martin Sloan Trust. The remainder would go into a trust for the grandchildren in equal amounts. However, on September 26, 2001, in the amendment to the trust, she went ahead and she eliminated the Lewis Siegel Trust, meaning the first $500,000 would have gone to petitioners. She also would have eliminated an immediate payment of $200,000. And what the vice chancellor found was that she did this because she was angry at Lewis Siegel because of his relationship with his pseudo-wife, Deborah Peduto. From that date until the execution of the codicil, Lewis Siegel had no stake whatsoever in the Martin Sloan Trust. Now, the second part of your question is what the vice chancellor actually found was regarding, let me take a sip here. There wasn't a mistake. He said Lewis Siegel made a mistake. He didn't say Patricia did. There was no finding that Patricia, nobody ever testified that Patricia was explained what went on. In May 27, 2003, Lewis Siegel appeared, and he was practicing law without a license at the time. He appeared on behalf of Patricia. And at that time, there was a discussion about what could be done. He was seeking to dissolve the trust. It was explained to him by opposing counsel judge he couldn't dissolve the trust. In his opinion, Vice Chancellor Shrine found that Lewis apparently realized at that point, Lewis realized that he couldn't dissolve the trust, and the only way that he could get it, he didn't dissolve the trust, and maybe he should have included in the will, which the August 28, 2002 will, which he had prepared. There's nothing about Patricia. There's nothing about what Patricia decided, what she knew. There's no testimony on the record that anyone discussed the execution or the exercise of the power of appointment from September 26, 2001, until she died. No testimony to that. And I want to add one other thing that wasn't in the brief, and I think it's significant. There is an exhibit, and it's at A727 to 728. It's the Courtyard Gardens Activity Assessment. This was filled out on September 4th, 2002. It's filled out by Lewis Siegel. There's a question in here. Do you enjoy books, which is directed by Patricia Sloan? And he said, only to look at pictures usually. This was not a sophisticated woman. No one, none of the doctors ever took a look at the document. None of them were asked whether she would have understood what the trust was, what the exercise of the power of appointment was. No testimony whatsoever that Patricia understood anything about the document, anything about the Martin Sloan Trust, anything about the exercise of the power of appointment. That's what happened. And it was really important that he found that Lewis Siegel realized this because, again, Lewis Siegel was in total control of Patricia.
Well, putting aside the content of the documents, the Vice Chancellor did conclude that it was, putting aside what you just said about the trust and the change after Lewis got involved with another woman, that Patricia consistently decided she wanted to exclude two of her sons. And you're saying that when Lewis got involved with what's characterized as his pseudo-wife, that she changed her mind and made a deliberate intention to include her other two sons.
No. I'm not saying she made a deliberate intention to include us. She was punishing him. And that's important because the position that's taken by respondent is once you saw her execute that will in August 28, 2001, she was never going to change her mind. She couldn't get angry at Lewis again and punish him. The second thing is that the choice – and Vice Chancellor Sloan acts as if there's a choice between either the petitioner's getting or respondent. And the logical fallacy is the fallacy of the excluded middle because there are grandchildren involved. Okay? And earlier she had set up a trust for the grandchildren. So it wasn't either us or Lewis. And it doesn't say, it doesn't matter if she didn't want us to have it. She also would have expressed a desire regarding the exercise of the power of appointment not to have her children. And if Lewis had advised her of anything, and there's no evidence on the record to believe that he did, because he didn't testify to it. I think we have to assume he didn't. There's no reason to believe he would give her proper legal advice and include the grandchildren and said, well, you can leave some to the grandchildren, that. That was the option she had.
Doesn't the record reflect that she didn't know some of her grandchildren?
She hadn't met the grandchildren of Jack Sloan, okay? But she had left it to them before, and she kept that intact in September 26, 2001. And again, that shows she treated her own will differently than she treated the exercise of the power of appointment. They were separate documents. They were separate decisions. It's one thing for her to personally want to make sure that her property, including her personal possessions, wouldn't go to us or our children. That would be our punishment. But as far as our stepfather's trust, that's a different issue, and it was treated differently.
What the Vice Chancellor seemed to attach some significance to the fact that coincidentally, on the day that this last document was executed, one of the physicians stopped by and made a note. What's your view of the significance of that event?
It's not... It's equivocal. In other words, she would not testify that she was competent to go ahead and that Patricia was competent to go ahead and execute a will, okay? She noted that on that date that she had seen her, and again, she sees a lot of patients. She's trying to remember. She doesn't remember exactly. She noted that Patricia was not oriented as to the place, but she didn't know how severe that was, all right? And this was not compelling testimony. The other thing is, we don't know. They appeared on the same day. We don't know how far apart it was. There was no testimony from her. She wasn't questioned what time of day she appeared. And respondent didn't testify at what time of day he appeared. So we don't know how far apart in time it was. And so we don't really know whether her condition would have been the same when she was presented with the codicil as when Dr. Dowie saw her. All right, and then again, Dr. Dowie just has the notes to go by. But The point that is important, you go ahead and what you take from this case is that he is in total control of her. And the testimony he gave was always, Mom wanted me to do this, Mom wanted me to do that. All right?
Well, his testimony was significantly discounted, wasn't it?
Actually, I have problems with that. The judge said he had significantly discounted it, but I'm not sure that I see where he discounted it. I do, however, note in my brief where he discounted it, discounted respondent's misconduct. All right?
That's the unclean hands argument?
It's not just the unclean hands argument. If you find, which I think you must, that he exploited her, and there's good cause to believe there was money laundering with cashing of over $290,000 worth of checks from one account. If you find that, then you find that he was disregarding her rights and the law. He was doing what he wanted. That would be consistent with undue influence. That would be consistent with bringing it here and saying, here, sign this, Mom. That's the importance of that. The importance of the concealment, the misrepresentation he made about being unemployed, being self-employed. In fact, he was unemployed. To go ahead and do as the Vice Chancellor did and say that it's a euphemism, the euphemism for being unemployed is between jobs. And as a matter of fact, in Lewis's testimony about 1996, when he got behind 2 months in his mortgage, he said, I was between jobs, so to speak. That's the euphemism for being unemployed. The euphemism is not that you were self-employed. That was intentional, material misrepresentation made under penalty of perjury. And the Vice Chancellor discounted that. The other finding that he made, which I have challenged in brief, is Lewis testified that his mother wanted him to retire and she wanted to support him so he could spend time with her and manage her affairs. The Vice Chancellor found there was nothing on the record to contradict it. To the contrary, there's a laundry list of things that contradict it. The actual truth of the matter is there was nothing on the record to corroborate it. Nothing. He wrote all the checks. He signed all the checks. He effectively looted her. An estate worth in more than $2 million was reduced to less than $20,000 by the time she died. He systematically converted her estate to himself. This exploitation is clear evidence that this wasn't simply a matter of him supporting himself. He also testified that he visited his mother once a week to take her to dinner. That didn't preclude him from gainful employment. This is about as bad as it gets on undue influence.
And do you want to save your remaining time?
I do. Thank you very much.
Mr. Jacobs.
Good morning. If you please the court. The court below determined that these were factual issues. It determined that looking through a record that itself took about 20 pages in its opinion to go through, that the factual basis here clearly showed that the root issue, as my appellant has just said, is whether or not the codicil carried out the intent of the testatrix. And it did. And the court below had ample evidence and committed no clear error with respect to his findings.
Is Dr. Bill going to testify on that narrow issue if his deposition had been introduced?
Dr. Bill, in his deposition, which was a discovery deposition, which I took because I wanted to know what he was going to say, he opined as to whether or not she might be competent on July 1st, 2003. That was that's what it was.
So the answer would be yes. He was going to directly relate to her competency at the time of the codicil.
That's what his testimony was going to relate to.
Okay.
If he testified at the trial.
Can you help me understand the ruling of the Vice Chancellor excluding that evidence? He asked basically, were you notified And when the answer was no, he said it's out, something like that.
Well, from that point of view, let's back up. The day before trial, we had a pretrial. At the pretrial, as the record clearly indicates, we were discussing which witnesses were appearing live. Dr. Bill was the one of the ones who was mentioned as a witness who was going to appear live. There was never any notification that he might not appear live.
I want to follow up on that because the pretrial stipulation, which is in the Court of Chancery docket, he filed December 22nd. Was that the same day as the conference? Or is it the
I don't remember. I think the pretrial was filed before, but it was very close to the all of this was very close to the trial, which I think started the day after the pretrial. I don't have the date of the pretrial specifically.
It has petitioner's witnesses, number 14, Aiden Bill, MD, expert opinions, live or by deposition transcript.
There's no doubt about it that in that all of the physicians were listed that way. And it was at the pretrial, which happened within a day or so of filing that, where we discussed which witnesses were going to appear live and which witnesses were not going to appear live. And Dr. Bill was going to appear live, according to Mr. Carucci, attorney for appellant at that time. There was never any question that he was going to appear live. If he appeared, if you read the pretrial, Mr. Carucci wasn't even positive he wanted him to appear at all. That's the statement of appellant's counsel at the pretrial. He wasn't certain if he wanted him to appear. So
is it your position that that conversation effectively amended the pretrial order?
Absolutely, because it was a listing of who would appear live, who would appear by deposition, and we had a long discussion of what witnesses were going to appear, and in fact, we were even talking about whether or not we had enough witnesses to fill up the time between the start of trial. And when I had listed Dr. Tavani, which was the second day of trial at 2 o'clock, and if you look at the pretrial, the Vice Chancellor says, I just want to make sure we have enough witnesses to fill up this time. I don't want a lot of dead time. And that was the first time, unfortunately, that I realized, not doing a lot of chancery work, that I didn't read in all the depositions of witnesses who weren't going to be alive, and that we knocked out basically probably about 3 hours of reading testimony. So there was a problem, and that's why we went over all the live witnesses and how they would appear. And there was no doubt that both Dr. Tavani and Dr. Bill were going to appear live.
All right. Now, do you agree that under the written stipulation, Dr. Bill could testify by deposition either in the case in chief or in rebuttal?
That's the way it was written.
But you're representation is that there's something in that transcript, if we read it, that is going to serve to modify this?
The only thing would be the recitation of which witnesses were clearly appearing live. And by the way, there was no recitation at any time why Dr. Bill, who lives in Alapocas, could not appear live. We had discussions of why other physicians, such as Dr. Weintraub, could not Weintraub, he was deceased, Weisberg could not appear live because he had a pre-planned vacation for a long time, and counsel agreed that he would be by deposition. But there was never any indication at any time up to the pretrial that there was any reason why Dr. Bill could not appear live. That was, I am sure, just a precaution, especially since counsel understood he was in the hospital several weeks before.
But if we look at the scenario as outlined in Justice Ridgely's questions, and you have a situation where the pretrial stipulation said Dr. Bill could appear live or in person, and you indicate the Vice Chancellor wanted to know about scheduling.
Correct.
So you're having a discussion about who's going to appear live.
Correct.
You seem to be suggesting that if we read a transcript of the office conference involving the pretrial stipulation, we're going to find that there was an irrevocable commitment to only have Dr. Bill testify live. And then when it transpired that he was unavailable, it was perfectly proper for the Vice Chancellor to say, he's out.
Irrevocable is probably a harsh word.
Well, that's what happened, though, because if you look at the pretrial stipulation, it says he can testify live or by deposition. It turned out he couldn't testify live, and the Vice Chancellor said, that's it. The only reason he would say that's it is if this pretrial conference amended the pretrial stipulation and deposition testimony of Dr. Bill was no longer an option.
In my mind, the pretrial conference clearly enunciated which witnesses were appearing live and superseded the pretrial stipulation, which was filed several days before the pretrial conference, which was one day before the hearing. I do not think you're going to find in there the Vice Chancellor making a ruling at that point. He just said, okay, which witnesses are appearing live, so I'll understand who is appearing live. And in at least two occasions, Dr. Bill was included in those witnesses who were alive. Is it irrevocable? If you look at the fact that he wanted to know how his trial was going to go and how he was and who was appearing and what he had to understand was happening, I would say, yes, it is irrevocable. Especially, even though he had it in his transcript that he might appear by deposition, the general rule, at least in the trial courts, is that if you have a witness who's local, you can put it down that way if there's a deposition, but you have to give some explanation as to unavailability, which is what we wanted. And at least you have to inform the court one day before that he definitely is not appearing live because he is ill and show that he's ill. Now, I think that those circumstances together gave the Vice Chancellor the right to keep it out. No information the day before trial, clear information on the record that he was appearing live because he was discussed as a live witness, and even though it was in the written pretrial, after the pretrial conference, it governs.
Are you saying that you have to demonstrate unavailability when the pretrial says someone will testify by deposition?
I am taking that position, absolutely. For a local witness, you have to at least made a showing as why.
Even if the parties stipulate? I mean, why would you waste time doing that if the parties stipulate that this testimony is by deposition? Why would a court want to waste time doing that?
Only, I don't think it was a waste of time. The stipulation when it was done, it was an open stipulation for all the witnesses who had been deposed. But I think when at the pretrial, it was changed.
Is that transcript in the record?
Yes. If please the court, I'll go on. With respect to the two documents which were executed in 2001, appellant makes a point that they're two separate documents, and they are. There was a will, and in the will she exercised the power of appointment in 1993. The 2001 codicil to that will did not change the exercise of that appointment, and in the appointment with respect to that will, she gave a large amount of funds to the Lewis Siegel Trust. Now, the fact that in her trust she combined the Lewis Siegel Trust and her other trust into a uni trust for whatever reasons, I can speculate taxes, does not mean that the intent to leave it to a Lewis Siegel Trust, which had been previously predefined, was changed. The will was still a document on its own, and the will specifically referred to the Lewis Siegel Trust. There's nothing to indicate that she changed her intent with respect to the Lewis Siegel Trust being the recipient of the bulk of the money from the Martin Sloan Trust. Rather, what she did was, in her own funds, not the Lewis Siegel Trust, she combined it into a uni trust, which was a way under the tax laws to totally make her estate tax-free. She consistently left a large portion to my client, Mr. Siegel. And with respect to the inferences that it was that pseudo-marriage in the middle of September which might have occurred, if you read the testimony of Mr. Grossman, it's clear that those changes were being made months before any marriage was even executed. And Mr. Grossman actually didn't start it. Joe Rosenthal started it, got Wilmington Trust involved. Then for some reason Wilmington Trust couldn't do it, and months before Mr. Grossman got it, created whatever she had thought about months before, and saw her once before the marriage, and indicated that whatever he had done with Wilmington Trust information was correct, and then she signed it without any discussion after the marriage. That inference is there, but I don't think it's an inference that has anything to do with the fact that she left a large portion and continued to leave a large portion of that Martin Sloan Trust to Louis Siegel. And the fact that her intent all along was to do that, I think you have to look at the will, and the will was important. The will showed what she wanted to happen with the trust, at least up through 2001, which was the Martin Sloan Trust was going predominantly to Louis Siegel, even if partially in trust and partially in cash. I believe that Dr. Dowie's testimony is very evident with respect to the execution of the codicil, as is the testimony not only on the specific date of the codicil, but her testimony with respect to Mrs. Sloan throughout her year and a half being her primary physician at the extended care facility. What Dr. Dowie said was, for the entire time, she was happy, she was well taken care of. Lewis took care of her well. Lewis made sure her medical condition was properly handled, and that the woman was very content. She also testified that there were phones that she could have used if she wanted. She also testified that the AIDS took her out of the restricted area into the general population many a time for functions. So she wasn't a captive who did not have ability to go out and do things beyond when Lewis was there. In fact, Lewis let her go out with an aide for dinner. So she had many opportunities to do whatever she wanted and use a phone if she wanted to. It was the home's decision whether or not she should have a phone, and they didn't want it for whatever reason with respect to it led to trouble. What trouble? One can only speculate with other people who lived within the restricted unit. So I believe that when you take the totality of the evidence with respect to her remaining totally competent, knowing her own mind the entire time, being cared for by her son and her daughter-in-law, and being a happy, content woman up through at least the time she broke her leg in 2004, that she knew what she was doing. And it's interesting. We are arguing here whether Lewis should have testified to, I told my mother A, B, C, and D. Well, what do we know is that if he had testified to A, B, C, and D, and both sides had the opportunity to ask him that question, the appellants didn't ask him that question. And by the way, the inference works both ways under the AMJUR. If the people who called him, which was the appellants, don't go back and try to find out what he did and what he didn't do by asking him, the inference is also that they didn't want to know, because he would have said exactly what they didn't want to hear. And that's the inference that they're throwing against us, because we didn't ask him. But what Lewis said was, when I understood we had to then change the trust. But he didn't say we. I understood we had to change the trust and have a codicil because of what the vice chancellor told him. With respect to the other actions of Lewis, I believe that they are irrelevant with respect to the actions he took with respect to the trust, the Martin Sloan Trust. There is no evidence, by the way, that he totally cleared out her estate. There is only evidence that he used a certain portion of the $1.5 million estate for his own use. Nobody ever went into, because it wasn't material, where he put the others, but we do know he took care of his mother, took care of all her needs, and took care of all her medical problems, and was a very close son. So I believe that the fact that he didn't say it is immaterial. And it's even more immaterial if the vice chancellor, because of his not telling him in a previous case that his mother was now in an extended care facility and not living with him, discounted his testimony. And what would the appellant say if he had testified? We don't believe him, just as I don't believe what he said with respect to his mother wanting to give gifts to his stepchildren, to Lewis's stepchildren. I believe that in the totality of the evidence it is, she was competent in August of 2002, when we have both Dr. Altshuler and Dr. Weisberg saying that she was clearly competent, understood what she was doing. It's consistent with what he did in 2001 with Mr. Grossman, when she, in her will, tried to make sure that her son and their heirs, both sons and their heirs, I mean, we're talking about grandchildren, that's their heirs, would receive nothing by the definition of what she indicated could be her heirs. Now, you could argue that that only applies to her will, but with respect to her understanding of whether or not both trusts were within her control, it would have applied to both. And I think that clearly the import of all the evidence is supportive of the Vice Chancellor's decision. And I also believe that the pretrial, just to go back to that for 1 second, although it gave the option, I think that it is the obligation under the rules that if you're not having a witness who lives in the state appear live once it's been said that he appears live, as it is in the transcript. And by the way, in the transcript, I am the one who read the list of witnesses off appearing live, just so the court realizes that. We were talking about it, and I went through all the witnesses, including Dr. Bill. Mr. Carucci never indicated that he was not appearing live. He went along, and the only thing he said was, I am not sure if he's appearing at all. That's what he said. So I believe that the Vice Chancellor clearly had the facts before him, and there was no undue influence. And why isn't there undue influence? I'll just go through that real quickly. There are five things with respect to undue influence, as the court knows. And I'm not going to argue with respect to shifting the burden. The only thing in the shifting of the burden which is vague in the law is what is a weakened intellect. The Vice Chancellor decided, based upon her having mild to moderate Alzheimer's, he understood that to be weakened intellect. I don't think the other cases that he cites are necessarily on point. I don't think that necessarily means she didn't understand what she was doing and how she was doing, but I can't argue that Alzheimer's is a mental process which makes one sometimes confused. But looking at the factors with respect to shifting, there is nothing here to demonstrate that the effect of the codicil went against the intent of the testator. There is nothing here to indicate that he exerted the influence to make his mother do what she hadn't said she wanted to do. So on three factors out of the five, with respect to the burden that Lewis had, he met that burden. And I believe that having met that burden, that the Vice Chancellor was correct. I have nothing else to say, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'll be brief because I have to. Both sides could have asked Lewis the question, well, we were there to meet our burden of proof. If this was simply where the burden of proof didn't shift, then maybe you could say, well, then it didn't impose any particular obligation on come forward with evidence. The judge found that the burden of proof had shifted, and shifted when we rested our case, and they knew that it shifted, and he had to come forward with an explanation, and he declined to do so. It wasn't equal on both sides. It's not our responsibility. This is an adversary system. It's not our responsibility to flesh out his case or to attempt to preclude him from proving his case. It is our responsibility to go ahead and shift the burden of proof under Melson and create the inference, the presumption, rather, of undue influence under Florida law, which we did. Now,
what is the relevance of Dr. Bill's testimony?
Dr. Bill's testimony, he was our expert, and a lot of what he had to say had to do with undue influence. That was really the strength of his testimony. Someone in a position like Lewis just had to show up. He was in control. If Patricia wanted to go out to dinner, if Patricia wanted anything, he would determine whether she got it. And he said, in circumstances like this with which he had experience, that someone in a position like that, of control, they will just agree with them. They don't want to anger them. And that's what he testified to. And that was the strength of the testimony, because that's the power of the position of control. Even if she were competent, is she going to say no? He prepares the document. She didn't have a choice of documents. He prepares it and brings it to her. If she says no and he's angry at her, what's going to happen to her? She's not in control of her own life. And that's what he testified to. He said being in that kind of a position is undue influence on its own. And in order to get around that, respondent would have had to demonstrate that he didn't. And that would have meant he had to testify and explain it. And he didn't. Now, opposing counsel said no evidence that he cleaned out her estate. The evidence was Lewis's testimony himself. He testified that at the time she died, the only thing she had left was the money in her trust account, which, if you look at the final statement, amounted to $16,000, and the personal property, the personal effects she had in his room. That was his testimony. So, yes, he had cleaned her out. And what was the cashing of the checks for if it wasn't to clean her out? That had nothing to do with her. Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess.